This show may contain words that would offend the sensibility of certain habitués of monasteries. It's Wednesday, June 5th, 2019. From Slate's The Gist, I'm Mike Pesca. Scott Peterson is in trouble. First of all, because he's named Scott Peterson. No, not that Scott Peterson. We're talking about the one who killed people only indirectly. Scott Peterson, the Broward County Sheriff, who was stationed at the Parkland High School, Marjorie Douglas High School, on the day of the shooting, and who did not a lot. He really did nothing. Talked into his shoulder walkie-talkie a bunch and stayed outside the building where the shooting was taking place. And for this, he's been charged officially, multiple counts, including neglect of a child and culpable negligence. Those are the official charges, but the real charge is cowardice. When I first heard about this, I was opposed to his being charged. It seemed an example of a mob mentality, the mob justified in its anger and anguish, but it did seem like scapegoating, no matter how blameworthy a person Peterson is. Also affecting my decision was that prominently quoted in the effort to get Peterson charged with crimes was Andrew Pollack. He is the father of Meadow Pollack, who died in the Parkland killings. Every step of the way, Andrew Pollack has loudly championed what I perceive to be the wrong policies. He took up a lot of conversation in the meeting with Donald Trump and gave Donald Trump a lot of verbal approval in the aftermath. He wants more guns, more armed teachers, a hardening of targets, but he never ever talks of gun control and he always steers the conversation away from that. He is really, really, really eager to see Scott Peterson rot in a jail cell. All that aside, should Peterson's cowardice really be a crime? Have a criminal element to it? The experts say it's going to be very hard to prove this case. The negligence charge is unlikely to stick. It could perhaps set a bad precedent. It just doesn't seem like Peterson's actions fit the definition of these charges. But I also think, in addition to the cowardice that Peterson showed, there's a kind of cowardice in the crowd pointing to one individual who failed them and wanting to take not his job, not his salary, which is proper and has been done, but to deprive him of his liberty. It's an example of retribution. I have seen a lot of the videos and I have read a lot of the reports, and there really is nothing to excuse Peterson. He was clearly derelict in his duty, and it is not a stretch to think that if he had acted differently, bravely, properly, that some children may be alive today who aren't. And if he gets prison time, it's not that I'll feel sympathy for him, but my narrow interests in one person's feelings, they're not the same as what the state's interest is. State versus Peterson shouldn't rest on whatever joy I or parents take in Peterson getting his comeuppance. Is it better for society to incarcerate the officer who fails to keep the peace? Maybe Scott Peterson in a jail cell will give the grieving a moment's solace. I actually don't think so. I think they may be feeling vindictive, but Peterson in jail does not offer true vindication. The guy is certainly guilty, but that is more of a societal designation than a legal one. On the show today, I spiel about candidates Warren and Biden and their environmental plans. Some say only crows can see such varied shades of green. But first, George Will is out with a new book, and it explains everything he's ever thought or will think, kind of. Will has long been one of the most prominent and eloquent voices on the right, and now we know why. All because of Madison. No, not Billy James. Just follow James Madison, and you'll do well as a country, until Woodrow Wilson comes and screws it all up. Old scores are settled, though no baseball is broached. In this conversation between me and George Will, he of the conservative sensibility. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically. The exterior, that's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, "Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender." And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay the neighbor and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we gvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. George Will has been a, if not the preeminent voice in conservative thought for, lo, these last 30 or 40 years. Not until now has he sat down and just written down exactly what he means by conservative thought, or rather, the conservative sensibility. George Will, thanks for being on The Gist.
Glad to be with you.
So I heard in an interview that you had designs to perhaps name this book The Closing Argument, although that maybe says something about the actuarial tables as much as it does your thought.
Yeah, someone suggested that, and I said, I'm not going anywhere. And it sounds like the first paragraph of an obituary. So, no, I wanted to say the conservative sensibility. A sensibility, to me, is more than an attitude and less than an agenda.
Yeah,
it's a way of experiencing the flux of events. And in the conservatives' case, it's a way of being comfortable with an undesigned, unplanned, out-of-control reality.
Which is now, or which would apply to what? Many times, I suppose, in our history, including during Wilson's era, as you point out repeatedly.
Well, ideally, it would apply to a free society at any time. But the whole point of a free society is that it is shaped by the spontaneous order from below and not the plans from above.
So do you think that if we had just listened to Madison, we'd be better off now? Or was it perhaps inevitable that the best thinking and best laid plans at the time were going to come smack into the reality of not just the design system, but the lived system?
I think, to answer the first part of your question, I think we'd be much better off if, as Madison envisioned, we had a government still of limited, delegated, and enumerated powers. I think we'd be better in many ways. But the most interesting aspect of the 20th century in American political thought was the remarkably forthright way in which progressives repudiated the founders and the remarkable success they've had in making that repudiation stick. Woodrow Wilson was the first president to criticize the American founding, which he did not do peripherally. He did it root and branch. He said the heart of the matter is the Madisonian constitutional architecture of the separation of powers is a mistake. He said it was all very well once when we were 4 million people living within 20 miles, 80% of us living within 20 miles of Atlantic Tidewater. But now we're a great nation, he said, united by steel rails and copper wire and all that stuff. So therefore, he said, historic non sequitur. Therefore, we need a government that can act with dispatch and power and nimbleness, and therefore, we must get rid of the separation of powers, the better to emancipate the modern presidency, the occupant of which, Wilson thought, would always look something like Woodrow Wilson.
Mm-hmm. Well, during Woodrow Wilson's time, the population of the United States went from under 100 million to over, but now it's well over 300 million. So was he wrong or just right but off by a matter of scale?
No, he was wrong. The mistake is to assume, and this was the progressive assumption, that the larger society becomes and the more complex it becomes, the more susceptible it is to governance from the center.
Mm-hmm.
The reverse is true. The more complicated society becomes, the more it depends on market forces to deliver information. That's what all a market is an information-generating device. And the less susceptible it is to central planning. There's a lot in my book about Friedrich Hayek, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, who popularized the term the fatal conceit, to believe that you can, when you intervene in complex systems, you can control the outcome. Whereas, in fact, the more complicated society gets, the less information can be had by government, particularly. and therefore government is apt to blunder more and more.
You've long been a critic of the New Deal, and you think that the only reason that the United States lifted itself out of the Great Depression was the war. So it had nothing to do with the New Deal?
Well, I do say that two things. First, the depression within the depression, that is what happened in 1937, was a larger contraction of the economy than occurred in 1929. The fact is that the United States was, the government was more interventionist than most of the governments in most of the countries afflicted by the Great Depression, and the United States took longer than most other countries did to recover from it. The recovery being, as you said, in response to the need to become the arsenal of democracy.
I would think that there's a lot of history that shows a couple of things. One is that Roosevelt started as someone who wanted to rein in spending and then shifted towards being a Keynesian. And that seems to have correlated with economic success, just as in our last, and this is what Bernanke said, just as in our last recession, though it was widely criticized, the amount of stimulus and spending, that seems to have correlated with a much more successful recovery in America than as compared to Western European countries that went the austerity route.
That certainly is arguable, but with regard to the Depression itself, the point, the criterion by which the New Deal wanted to be judged was curing unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
Unemployment never came below 14% before we began, as I say, to become the arsenal of democracy. And Secretary of the Treasury Morgenthau said in 1940, he said, we spent all this money, we simply haven't made progress. And that by their own criterion, they were not a success. It is no accident, comrade, as the Marxists used to say. It is no accident that in 1964, when I cast my first presidential vote, cheerfully, for Barry Goldwater, in the memory of whom my book is dedicated, 70% of the American people said they trusted the federal government to do the right thing all the time or almost all the time. Today, that's below 20%.
Mm-hmm.
So as governments' pretensions have grown, its prestige has plummeted, and partly because, and this is the irony of history, Barry Goldwater lost in an enormous landslide that swept in a liberal legislative majority into Congress for the first time since Roosevelt lost it over the court packing plan in 1938. And for a few years there in the 1960s, the government could do whatever it wanted on the liberal agenda, and it did. And as I say, the prestige of government has been going down ever since.
Because of the actions of government. I mean, those polls started to crater in response to Vietnam and Watergate.
Indeed they did, but also in response to disappointment over the interventions of the Great Society that produced something less than most people would feel a great society. My man Goldwater, who of course lost 44 states in 1964, I like to say that he actually won in 64. It just took 16 years to count the votes. He was a creative loser in that he changed the American vocabulary. He changed the Republican Party. He gave the rising set of young intellectuals organized around Milton Friedman and Hayek and others, gave them confidence. And as a result, the Republican Party became a conservative party.
Is it possible for that to happen with the Democratic Party if, say, a candidacy of someone like Bernie Sanders doesn't win many states but could change minds or change the alignment of the party?
It's hard to say. I'm afraid that if Bernie Sanders ran and lost badly, which I suspect he would, people would, in that case, say, let's not do that again.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, someone like Elizabeth Warren, who has an enormous intellectual self-confidence and a quite astonishing array of plans to fix this, that, and the other thing, she could, I think, by staffing up agencies and by staffing up the party, she could make a lasting difference.
But if you don't like central planning, you must not like Elizabeth Warren. Do you think differently of her than Bernie Sanders? Do you have more respect for her plans?
I do. I think she has a firm grip on half a point. The firm grip is this. She says, we have this enormous government, And it's become the plaything of special interests, of the rent seekers that I talk about repeatedly in the conservative sensibility. And she's right. It was a libertarian in Washington, someone at the Cato Institute, who said, look, if you set out a picnic, you expect to draw ants. And the federal budget's the biggest picnic in the world. And this is why 5 of the 10 most affluent counties by per capita income in the United States are in the Washington area. Washington has no natural resources, doesn't manufacture anything except laws, regulations, and trouble. But she looks at it and says, what we need to do to correct this is make the government bigger. Mm. It seems to me that's exactly the mistake. What you want to do is withdraw the government from so much importance in allocating wealth and opportunity. That would be an answer, particularly because she is the kind of person who is going on and on at all times about, as most progressives do, about campaign finance reform. Well, goodness, if you want to reduce the amount of money in politics, reduce the amount of politics in the allocation of money. It's quite simple.
Do you think, though, that her critique of crony capitalism, do you take it mostly as a critique of capitalism that happens to include the subset of crony capitalism? Or do you think that it is more targeted and pointed? As she says, she identifies herself as a capitalist, but she wants to rein it in. Do you take her at her word, or does it not matter because her solutions are all based on federal government policy?
Both. Yeah. I take her at her word that she thinks of herself as a capitalist to her bones, as she has said, and that she doesn't understand. See, what she does not understand is what public choice theory has taught us, thanks to James Buchanan and others at the University of Virginia, for which he won the Nobel Prize. What public choice theory says, reduced to its essence, is in the private sector, people try to maximize their affluence. In the public sector, people are motivated the same way. They want to maximize their power. And what public choice theory does is it deromanticizes government. It says, do not think of government as a collection of disinterested experts of the sort that progressives for one century now have been promising to put in charge of our lives. Government is itself, in Madison's terms, a faction. It just happens to be the biggest faction of them all. And it gets big because people tend to think of it sentimentally as this unique island of disinterestedness in an otherwise a society that is otherwise a maelstrom of interestedness. That's Elizabeth Warren's difficulty. She keeps spinning these new ideas of new laws and new agencies and all the rest, and she clings to this view that government is somehow going to be A, deft, and B, disinterested.
Well, you're not a pure libertarian. You believe
Certainly that there
are some government functions that serve us all better than the private sector.
I happen to believe that laissez-faire is a government creation. Markets depend on laws and adjudications and contracts and judicial enforcement. Some people say conservatives appreciate the law of unintended consequences. I think conservatives are conservatives often because of that, which is that when you intervene in a complex society, the unintended consequences of your action are apt to be larger than and contrary to the intended consequences.
Is the current Republican Party dignified?
Of course not. A cult of personality never is.
Okay, I ask you that because in 2012, I was watching a past lecture you gave, and someone asked you about partisanship, and you defended partisanship just on the basis of like-minded people tend to cluster. We call these clusterings parties, and this gives our politics weight and dignity. You said that. So it seemed to me you were saying a natural consequence of how we've clustered is that the parties will have dignity.
That's right. As long as what they cluster about are perceptions of society, ideas of right and wrong, sense of social justice, and all the rest. When you drain away the intellectual content from partisan arrangements, you get cults of personality, which is what the Republican Party has become.
What do you think of the argument lately raised about impeachment that we owe it to the Constitution?
Well, I'm not sure. You have to find a place where he has violated the Constitution.
Well, the Oath of Office Clause, for instance.
Well, again, what has he violated? People say, well, obstruction of justice. Here's the problem with that. If you think of impeachment as retrospective, that is, as vengeance or as punishment for deeds committed, where do you start? Mm-hmm. Start with, for example, the firing of Jim Comey. That the president was exercising a core presidential power, that is, to remove the head of a federal agency, is clear. Therefore, you have to say, well, he should be impeached because he exercised a core presidential power with a corrupt motive. Well, then, the corrupt motive was ostensibly to obstruct an investigation. But A, he didn't stop the investigation. And B, the investigation didn't find the underlying offense that some people have postulated. So, indeed, I think that the damage done by Donald Trump's public manner, by ringing certain bells that will never unring, putting it into play and normalizing a kind of civic discourse that is extraordinarily damaging, I think this is going to be much more lasting in its damage than Nixon's surreptitious burglaries were. But try to make the impeachment ground on that. We had a very bad election in 2016. The cure for a bad election is a better election. Let's get on with it. It is astonishing to me how much energy the Democratic candidates today are devoting to things they know are not going to happen, such as abolishing the Electoral College, something also that is not going to happen.
Mm. I want to ask you, as I told you, I have gone back and looked at a bunch of your speeches and a bunch of your writing. And for over a decade, you've been noting that ours is the only industrial government without a serious socialist redistributive party. I have a speech from 2007 where you got a laugh in front of the Cato Institute, a conservative crowd, by saying how ridiculous it would be if a Democratic candidate proposed a 70% tax rate.
No one running for president in 2008 is going to say, I have a bright idea. Let's repeal the great achievement of the 1980s. Let's go back to 70% marginal tax rates that existed before Ronald Reagan.
Which was the exact number that AOC proposed. Now that things seem to be shifting from what we always observed was happening, what's your explanation or diagnosis for that?
Well, first of all, I think there's an enormous extrapolation from pretty slender data about the popularity of socialism, particularly among people who haven't a clue what they mean by that. Lenin said it's government control of the commanding heights of the economy. Now, that has been watered down over the years. So socialists say, well, actually what socialism is government regulation of business combined with redistribution, aggressive redistribution of income. If that's your definition of socialism, we've had it for quite a while. 67% of the federal budget is transfer payments to individuals. The skies of America are dark with checks going back and forth as we redistribute income. So first of all, about socialism, it would be helpful if its advocates would define the darn thing, because they'd find that they're much less radical than they think they are.
Well, if anything, that's a rebuke to the Republican talking point of this guy's a socialist, that guy's a socialist.
Of course it is. Yeah. Of course it is. We'll go straight from socialism as an antique concept to socialism as a fright term without ever defining it.
George F. Will has been writing a syndicated column on politics for The Washington Post since 1974. I have in my hand his 16th book. It is called The Conservative Sensibility. George Will, thank you so much.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you for having me.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying, unflattering things about the war effort and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. Joe Biden released his environmental plan along with a claim that he was a revolutionary.
So today, I'm announcing my plan for a clean energy revolution. It outlines what we have to do to meet this challenge head on and how we're going to get there. We're going to invest $1.7 trillion in securing our future so that by 2050, the United States will be 100% clean energy economy with net zero emissions.
There's a lot in this plan that echoes the Green New Deal. In fact, it specifically endorses the framework of the Green New Deal. I'm not sure what that means, but that's okay. The Green New Deal is a little vague itself. Biden's plan is a major improvement over the worst fears of environmentalists who went scorched earth over the phrase middle ground. That two-word phrase, middle ground, caused a groundswell of opposition when it appeared a couple weeks ago in a Reuters report titled Exclusive, Presidential Hopeful Biden Looking for Middle Ground Climate Policy. Here was the quote that launched that headline. It was from a Biden advisor who also served in the Obama administration, Heather Zeichel. I respect where they, activist groups, are coming from, Zeichel said. What we learned from the Obama administration is unless we find middle ground on these issues, we risk not having any policies. The respect to the activist groups was not mutual. Oh, it was not. Quote, a middle ground policy that's supportive of more fossil fuel development is a death sentence for our generation and the millions of people on the front lines of the climate crisis, said Varshini Prakash, the co-founder of the Sunrise Movement. More fossil fuel development, no one was actually proposing that. And in fact, what the middle ground actually was, a middle ground between, unclear. It was a phrase, doesn't seem to be attached to anything tangible. Still, Prakash added, if Biden were serious about creating jobs for working people, he'd support the Green New Deal. Instead, he's taking a page from the oil and gas lobby's playbook. Well, taking a page from playbooks actually did happen, but it wasn't the oil and gas lobby. The Biden plan took some pages, perhaps plagiaristically so, from environmental playbooks. So you gotta ask yourself, what's the bad thing, listening to the oil lobbyists or just the taking of pages in general? Overall, Biden's plan does not seek to drill for more CO2-producing fuels. It, in fact, seeks to spend $1.7 trillion eliminating the nation's net carbon emissions by 2050. Okay, and with that, and with the plan that was pretty good, though not perfect, Sunrise said, you know what? We're wrong. We overreacted. No, they didn't say that. What they did say was, you know, without us, the nightmare would have been upon us. Quote, the pressure worked, said Sunrise Executive Director Varshini Prakash. We forced them to backtrack, and today he put out a comprehensive climate plan that cites the Green New Deal and names climate change as the greatest challenge facing America and the world. He backtracked. From what? I guess from the two-word phrase middle ground and all that could have meant, from accommodationalism to hobbits. I get it. Activists gotta activate. And they never overreact. They simply raise awareness and keep everyone in line. Elizabeth Warren also unveiled a green plan. She touted it in a campaign stop in Michigan last night.
This environmental catastrophe bearing down on us may be the biggest challenge yet. But how do we beat it? How do we beat it? We do it by what we've always done as Americans. We invest in science, in innovation, and in American workers. That's how
Her plan is more aggressive than Biden's. It will spend $2 trillion, not $1.7 trillion. She also wants net zero emissions by 2030, which, as I have noted on the show, is a near impossibility. There is a counter argument to my claim that it is a near impossibility, and it goes like this. Only because of political will, yes. Zero auto deaths are also not possible because of political will. We lack the political will to ban every car tomorrow. The 2030 number is signaling. Maybe you could say it's a negotiating tactic. I have found out that, just pointing out that zero emissions by 2030 is unrealistic, that gives rise to the claim, which I've been called many times, a climate delayer, which of course is supposed to sound like climate denier, which is like a Holocaust denier, or maybe just like climate denier, a guy who is saying that the earth is not warming, which is definitely not what I am. Also, let's be honest here, the climate is not going to get delayed or hurried up no matter what I say or think, but it is very tempting for a certain sort of person to charge another sort of person with genocide-adjacent beliefs, and I can't fight it, so I don't. Warren not only supports the Green New Deal, I want you to know, she affixes green to a lot of other programs. Turns out Warren has a plan for it. She has a Green Apollo program. She has a Green Industrial Mobilization program. And she has something called the Green Marshall Plan, which is also a lot like what Biden wants to do, get all the nations together and really, really hunker down. So Green New Deal and Green Marshall Plan, one day the president will make up his or her own policies with their own distinct names. But I guess for now, we are reliant on World War II era greatest hits collections in new environmentally conscious packaging. Soon we'll have the green storm the beaches at Normandy. The green fear is fear itself. The how green was my Tennessee Valley Authority. And D-Day will be Green Day, or maybe something like Green American Idiots. Sounds like a plan, which it is, and which it only is. The candidates obviously want to propose the largest things they can propose. There is no point in pre-negotiating with themselves and hemming in their ambitions to play to some imagined opposition. But you know what? The opposition actually isn't imagined. It's there. And it's not just boogeymen or conservatives who deny global warming or oil and gas lobbyists. There are lots and lots of people who are really worried about global warming, really want to do something about it, but will really have to give up things in the real world that they might not be eager to give up. In fact, they might not be able to give up. Yesterday in New York State, Governor Andrew Cuomo, Democrat, said of the New York State Senate, controlled by Democrats, that they screwed up. There just isn't enough time to pass their environmental agenda. The Senate couldn't get its act together to make the New York State power grid carbon neutral by 2040. This is doable, and not in the if only we had the political will way. This really could be done. We just have to do it. And it irks me that presidential plans and talks of death sentences get a lot of attention, but what's lightly reported are actual plans that actual states could be actually doing to actually lessen emissions, and they're not doing it. And there you have it. We are by turns not serious enough about environmental policy and on such a knife's edge of blame and recrimination if you get any part of an imagined policy less than perfect. This is not a world we want to live in. And if the inertia surrounding environmentalism continues, it won't be much of a world at all. And that's it for today's show. Pierre Bien-Aimé and Daniel Schrader have unveiled the green chicken in every pot. TJ Raphael, senior producer of Slate Podcast, is champion of the good green 5-cent cigar. Do you guys subscribe to the Slate newsletter? It's at slate.com/gistnews. You'll get some reading recommendations, links to all the shows, and an answer to this trivia question. It's kind of conceptual. What do baseball's seventh inning stretch and Handel's Messiah have in common? Oh, it's a tough one. If you get it, you'll be in the elite gold circle. What do the seventh inning stretch and Handel's Messiah have in common? I asked George Will. He got half of it right. Let's see how you do. The Gist, Tippecanoe and Kermit 2. Oomperoo, deperoo, dooperoo, and thanks for listening.